movements are always led by students. We had students protesting the Vietnam War, demanding Black studies and ethnic studies, and making good trouble, as John Lewis would say. He made that statement on March 1st, 2020, in commemoration of Bloody Sunday on March 7th, 1965, when hundreds of protesters who were protesting police brutality were beat up by law officers as they marched across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And Bloody Sunday, if you remember, if you saw Selma, the film Selma, that was highlighted in Ava DuVernay's film. So there's a young man at the Brookings Institute named Rayshawn Ray, who summarized the five takeaways we have from John Lewis. And they have implications for how we address anti-racism and the erosion in democracy today. They were, your vote matters. How many people voted yesterday? Your vote matters. Okay. And you are never too young to make a difference. John Lewis was the youngest person to speak at the March on Washington in 1963, but he made an impact. Look at who started Black Lives Matter. Look at who was protesting during the Vietnam War, during the Civil Rights Movement, the young people. If you want to make sure that there's going to be movement, hook on to the young people. Number three, you must be willing to speak up and speak out against injustice, no matter the cost. And when we look at what our civil rights leaders have endured, when we look at what people in the Black Lives Movement have endured, when we look at even what people now in this horrible war in the Middle East are enduring, you know, there's something about there's injustice, but you have to keep going. Never give up. And he also said, number four, you must be a racial equity voter. You have to speak out for people who cannot speak out for themselves. You have to make sure that you are at the table. Now, that's something that Shirley Chisholm always told us. Make sure you're at the table. You can't have an impact if you're not at the table. And you must never give up. One of the first bills that John Lewis passed was to create the National Museum of African American Heritage and Culture. And until his dying day, he never gave up. So we are at a time in history in our nation where white supremacy continues to rise, our democracy is threatened, anti-hate acts, crimes, and rhetoric abound virtually and physically in our political and public spaces, on our college campuses, and even in our homes and places of worship. Macro and microaggressions against Blacks, Jews, Muslims, Latinos, Asians, immigrants, and the LGBT community are rampant. And many of us are moving through our streets with fear. So what do we do now? And I'm going to suggest we are now witnesses to what Peniel Joseph, the historian, calls in his book, The Third Reconstruction. Reconstruction is in the history of our nation. Reconstructions occur when there's much violence. They're characterized by racial violence, political divisions, and a resulting backlash. And Peniel Joseph calls reconstructions watershed moments in the history of our nation. So he goes through three reconstructions that we've had. And I suggest if you want to look at that more thoroughly, you pick up his book, which came out this year. He underscores that hate and blood and shame are still deeply embedded in the 21st century. He posits that the first Reconstruction from 1895 to 1898 was followed by decades of Jim Crow with a mendacious principle of separate but equal. The power gained by Black people was usurped right away by violence in the form of lynchings, voter suppression, and exploitive sharecropping, and the criminalization of Blacks through chain gangs, which still have continued in the form of mass incarceration today. And some have said it feels like we're going backwards. Reminders of the first Reconstruction exist in our communities. We see it in our state governments, in our Congress. White supremacist acts are destructive and real. And I remember when Trump was elected, I was teaching the book, which chronicled the massacre that occurred in Wilmington, North Carolina, the mass riots that occurred, Charles Chestnut's book, Margins, what is the name of the book? But his Charles Chestnut's book, where he chronicles what happened when whites felt that Blacks were getting too much in control. My students said, this reminds me of Reconstruction. So we have these memories of Reconstruction, that first Reconstruction, that appear sporadically throughout the history of our nation. Joseph argues that the second Reconstruction spanned the civil rights era from May 17th with the Supreme Court's decision in Brown versus the Board of Education to Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination in 1968. We thought the situation would change. We had the voting rights was passed, but as we know, it was not supported and sustained in 2022. Civil rights leaders and community members and parents who had fought for integrated schools saw and can see now that schools are more segregated than ever. The discrepancy in criminal sentencing of whites and Blacks remains wide. There's still discrepancies in housing and employment for whites versus Blacks. So the second Reconstruction resulted in another change when President Barack Obama was elected. We had hope. We thought, here we go again, right? But what happened? We had the backlash, the Black Lives Matter movement, the attempted takeover of the United States Capitol. So once again, although we celebrated the 60th anniversary of the March on Washington this August, we still see widespread violence and opposition to racial equity and civil rights. So where do we go from here? Hence the name of the talk, the fire this time, and making a space for creating good trouble. We can look at our writers. Our writers expose the truth, explore the joy, the pain, and our fears. Our writers bear witness to our stories. That's what James Baldwin did. He was a bearer of witness. He was a witness. And they reclaim and complicate the past. They offer us counter narratives. They raise awareness of social and political issues, and they enable us to confront the deepest part of ourselves, our secrets, our anxieties, our personal and our collective memories. Jesmyn Ward, the award-winning novelist, disturbed by what she was witnessing, wanted to hear how the writers, scholars, and public intellectuals from her generation were bearing witness to the rise in the culture of anti-hate, racism, and violence. James Baldwin had done it in his book of essays, The Fire Next Time. So in the tradition of James Baldwin, Jesmyn Ward asked her contemporaries to contribute to a book called The Fire This Time, A New Generation Speaks About Race. And I would suggest that you take a look at that book. The result was a collection of essays, poems, fiction, and creative nonfiction that examined the past, gave different perspectives on the master narrative representing the history and literature in our country, and reminded us of the importance of legacy. And some of the titles from the book will give you a picture of what writers were saying. Jericho Brown wrote The Tradition. He's a poet. The Weight We're Carrying by Rachel Kadazi Ganache. Lonely in America by Wendy Walters, which really reflects on what it's like to feel isolated and really invisible in America. Where Do We Go From Here? Isabel Wilkerson, we know her work. The Dear Pledges of Our Love, a defense of Phyllis Wheatley's husband. Changing the narrative. If you look at what people said about Phyllis Wheatley's husband, they said he treated her very poorly, that her death may have been the result of his neglect of her. But she gives us a different narrative. She did the research. White Rage by Carol Anderson. Cracking the Code by Jesmyn Ward. Queries of Unrest by Clint Smith. Blacker Than Thou by Kevin Young. And The Art of Storytelling. The Fire This Time, A New Generation Speaks About Race, offers a blueprint for how we move forward and begin again. And as I said, our writers and scholars are truth tellers. They are griots, for they convey the cultural and the history memories of a people. They are the ones that we look to for critical commentary in our society. So as we look for ways to move forward, we must begin again, as the scholar Eddie Glau says in his book, that gives an in-depth analysis of James Baldwin, the man, the writer, and the activist. And again, we can't stop. What does that mean for us as academics and educators in institutions of higher education? I'm going to look at the theme of this 16th National Black Writers Conference at Megar Evers. It was called The Beautiful Struggle, Black Writers Lighting the Way. And our writers who participated in that conference explored the ways in which we move forward by engaging in deep conversations about our past, present, and future. They emphasize the importance of struggle, persistence, and resilience that can be found in the work of Black writers. Using their stories, essays, poetry, and fiction, they spoke on roundtables that represent the kind of exciting and substantive collective conversations we can have in seminars and in our classrooms. The themes that emerged from their stories are motivation for examining how we provide authentic ways to discuss uncomfortable topics, because again, that's where we are. We have to create spaces to discuss uncomfortable topics, disturbing topics. Those roundtables, Between the World and Me, The Social Responsibility of the Black Writer. What responsibility do we have to our nation, to serve, to our community? What is the responsibility of the writer? The writer suggests that we all have a responsibility. As Shirley Chisholm said, service is the rent you pay to live on this earth. And Marion Wright Edelman says, the sea is so wide and my boat is so small, in her book. The Souls of Black Folk was another panel, telling our stories. Again, we have to tell our stories. Nobody Knows My Name, Race Relations in Black Literature. Making a Way Out of No Way, Healing the Community. And From the Margin to the Center, Gender, Sexuality, and Feminism in Black Literature. These are starting points for having discussions, for having debates, for writing papers. And our upcoming conference, All That We Carried, Where Do We Go From Here, is taken from Taya Miles's book, All That She Carried, The Legacy of Ashley's Ashes, the ashes of a woman who was enslaved. And knowing that her daughter was going to be sold, she gave her a sack. And that sack, this is based on a true story, was carried over several generations. it surfaced again in the 1920s. And Taya Miles did the research. And that sack can be viewed in the Smithsonian National Museum of African American Art. So we took that title of that book to look at where are we now, all that we carry, because we've carried a lot in this nation. We've carried a lot. Other groups have carried a lot. Let's look at what we've carried and beware of those who are trying to erase the history and ignore what we've carried. So the writers and scholars who are coming from different parts of the United States and the Americas are giving the Black gaze on their experiences. They're going to address the themes like technology, social media, and the fight for racial justice. We can fight for racial justice in a different way because of the technology and the media we have. Again, the healing power of literature. Black writers' letters to America. Again, giving that perspective. That's based on a book that Pamela Newkirk wrote, Letters to America, in which she chronicled the letters that writers, Black people, were writing from the 1800s. And those writers were from the everyday people, but they were also from our civil rights leaders, from our educators, from our politicians. In fact, the last letter in that book is two letters when Toni Morrison writes to Barack Obama on getting the election. And then Alice Walker also writes to him, I think, when he was nominated. Two of our writers. See, these are what our writers do. So we're at a crossroads. And I said, the fire this time, James Baldwin said, the fire next time. We're in the midst of a symbolic fire. So what can we do to make good trouble in the midst of this fire? As educators and academics and higher education and in the public school system, we can be the leaders in effecting change and addressing the anti-hate acts in our society. And we have to have a holistic approach that's going to involve the whole community, faculty, staff, students, community organizations that are pursuing these goals. We have to build coalitions with other groups who address racial equity, inequity, and social justice. There's now a growing interest in ethnic studies, particularly ethnic studies rooted in the diaspora of Africa. There's a strong desire for more students to take programs focused on examining the complexities of the Black experience from many perspectives. In response to that, many colleges are now requiring students to take a course or a series of courses focused on ethnic studies and social justice curricula. At CUNY, I was one of the commissioners for the what's called BRESSI, the Black Racial and Ethnic Studies Initiative, which looked at how we could make more students and faculty and staff aware of the necessity of studying Black studies and of increasing the number of Black faculty and students in our university and ensuring that there's a presence. We were able to come up with research projects that faculty throughout CUNY, 126 research projects became out. This was a grant funded by Mellon Foundation. And what the exciting thing, believe it or not, CUNY had done this. We are now working on a PhD program on Black race and ethnic studies. Times are changing, and that's because of persistence. And that's because people are never giving up and people are speaking out. And nothing will happen unless you do that. The University of Pittsburgh now mandates that a student's first year and incoming students take a class on anti-racism. And in California, a new law requires that all California state university systems take an ethnic studies course. Other schools, such as the University of Texas at San Antonio, have added electives on the Black Lives Matter movement. So there are many things going on. But despite that, we have to remember, again, I'm going to go back to persistence. We still have an increasing number of books being banned. Beloved by Nobel laureate and prize-winning author Toni Morrison, The 1619 Project by Nicole Hannah-Jones, who people are getting threats. I mean, not only are individuals walking in fear, but our writers and scholars are walking in fear, and they're being attacked. So, I mean, look at what happened with Salman Rushdie. I mean, that was horrible. And although we see this rise, Black literature and Black art have been the target of censorship and repression for decades, but now it's just much more open. And stop, it just ebbs and flows. So the books, ironically, which are disappearing from our classrooms and libraries in the public domain, are sometimes being targeted by school boards. Sometimes school boards are complicit in this. Politicians we know are complicit because we see this. And parent groups are sometimes complicit in this. And so the campaign we have of repression is devastating, and it's really preventing all of us from seeing the multifaceted nature of the Black experience in this country. Our classrooms, again, can provide that nurturing and safe space to hold difficult conversations about race relations, ethnocentrism, the violation of democracy, violence, anti-Semitism, and Islamophobia. So our challenge is to identify the strategies that we can use to have those difficult conversations and to have cross-cultural dialogues. We have to make sure that we participate in having culturally responsive curriculum from K through 16, which is why I was very excited about seeing finally, after all these years, Black studies being mandated in New York City schools. It's amazing that it's taken so long. And we can begin with the young. We have a program at Mid-Rivers College that's promoted by sponsored by the Center for Black Literature called Re-envisioning Our Lives Through Literature. And it's a program where students have books. We buy books for them, high school students, middle school students, and we bring teaching artists into the classroom. And the teaching artists work with teachers and students to look at the themes of the books and to create their own stories, their own texts. And they come out at the end, they have an anthology they contribute to, which is printed online and in person. And then they do a culminating performance. But listen to the themes that we've had over the last few years. Let's activate. This is what we're telling young people. Let's activate. Lest we forget, we cannot forget. Moment of truth, we will not be ignored. Going back to making good trouble. We have to start with the young. So our students are very excited. You can see the bonding that occurs because we're giving them something they can connect to. Our college classrooms also provide spaces where we can participate in what Mary Louise Pratt calls contact zones. And she first talked about contact zones in a 1991 keynote address at the Modern Language Association. She called the arts of the contact zone. And she articulated the fact that I use this term to refer to social spaces where cultures meet, clash, and grapple with each other. Cultures meet, clash, and grapple with each other, often in context of highly asymmetrical relations of power, such as colonialism, slavery, or their aftermaths, as they have lived out in many parts of the world. It's a way of looking how power is negotiated or where struggle occurs. So any text you're teaching, you have to create a contact zone so that you can really explore the power relations that were occurring at that time, to look at the tensions, to look at the struggles that people engaged in. You know, one example I like to use is when I taught Heart of Darkness. And I was teaching as a I was a visiting professor at the College of Staten Island, which had predominantly white students, many of them Italian and Irish. And I was also teaching at Meg Rivers College, which had a predominantly Black population. And I wanted to see the reaction of the students. My students at Meg Rivers could not believe that I would give them a book like Hearts of Darkness to read, that look at all the stereotypes and the ways that Africans were portrayed. But the students at Staten Island, College of Staten Island, didn't see anything wrong with it. They didn't have the history. They didn't have the context zone. So one of the things I used in teaching that was Chinua Achebe's essay, where he critiques how Joseph Conrad uses Heart of Darkness. So we read those texts alongside of each other. And that helped to create the context zone and helped to educate students at the College of Staten Island why they were not seeing this, looking at the book in the same way that the Black students were looking at it. And my students at Meg Rivers, when they saw the essay, they got excited. They said, oh, this is real scholarship. Now I can let other people know, you know, about what I'm reading. You know, look at what I can do. There are other people who are critiquing this. So that's a way to engage students. The contact zone is a way for making sure that we get all voices heard, but we get them heard in a space that is documented and where we can see the research. We are the ideal people to do that. So we have to help students in our classrooms to enact and imagine the other, to create points of empathy, and to get at the root of fear and hate. We lost bell hooks a couple of years ago. I think it's been almost 2 years. And her book, All About Love, was on the New York Times bestsellers list for, I think, something like 30 weeks or something. But that's a book I would refer to. And bell hooks talks about love as a powerful force that can lead to radical change and liberation from oppressive systems. It's not romantic. It's not a romantic sentiment. But she argues that it's a communion with the world. It's an act of transformative labor that offers an important pathway for personal and political growth. Love, including self-love, is an essential part of the movement for change. And she argues for radical love, which means you get at the root of how you're going to affect that change. We need radical love in our classrooms. Love that goes beyond the romantic, love that's going to help people to grow. And we cannot address any of these issues without looking at white privilege. Sometimes we don't even see entitlement, microaggressions against others, and assumptions. We have to look at that right in the face. And we can do that by having teach-ins, debates, structured debates, workshops, readings, looking at anti-racism, anti-Semitism, discrimination, anti-Asian acts. CUNY has just launched a series of initiatives that's going to look at anti-hate. They are funding colleges across the university that will look at ways that they can address anti-hate and anti-Semitism on their campuses. But we have to, when we engage in this, we have to look at the language we're using. And going back to writers, they give us a way to look at that language and establish some ground rules for how we will engage in constructive solutions for change and healing. Writing, going back to that, is a very deliberate process that encourages self-reflection and personal growth. And we have to give our students more opportunities to write in the classrooms. Students are very different than they were when many of us were coming up. You send them home to write something and that may never get done. I'm sure many of you can relate to that. So we have to create different kinds of classrooms and give them that space to write and to discuss and to debate. We have to think outside of the box and find more dynamic and creative ways to connect our scholars and our students with the subject matter that we're trying to teach. And that can happen in any way. So I'd like to leave you with the names of several readings that represent how we can use literature to inspire students to make good trouble. Jelani Cobb and David Remnick edited a book called The Matter of Black Lives, writing from the New Yorker. And it's a group of essays that provide a portrait of the impact of race in America from a range of voices represented by novelists, poets, essayists, journalists, and public intellectuals. They begin with James Baldwin's essay, Letter from a Region in My Mind, that was written in the New Yorker in 1962. And they close with Hilton Al's Homecoming, written in 2020. Those essays will give you a comprehensive view of race relations in areas such as politics, the arts, history, legal studies, and popular culture. And again, that can be a talking point for having a much deeper conversation around these areas. One of the writers I most admire is the Haitian novelist Edwige Dondekat. She wrote a book called Create Dangerously, The Immigrant Artist at Work in 2010. And she says about that book, create dangerously for people who read dangerously. This is what I've always thought it meant to be a writer. Writing, knowing in part that no matter how trivial your words may seem, someday, somewhere, someone may take a risk to read them. Someone may take a risk. So you must create dangerously. And she reflects in that book on artists who have been exiled and examines what it means to be an immigrant artist from a country in crisis. That was written in 2010. This is 2023. Very relevant today. She tells her story and she tells the artists who, because of horrors, were driven from their homelands. And this is a play. The last play written by Mary Baraka is called The Most Dangerous Man. A script that focused on a period in W.E.B. Du Bois's life when, as a public intellectual, he was being threatened in 1950. Woody King had the script. He created the play, The Most Dangerous Man. But W.E.B. Du Bois had become chairman of a nuclear disarmament group and was accused of being an agent of a foreign state. The indictment led to the confiscation of his passport. And ironically, many of his colleagues at the NAACP rejected him. That's the group he helped to found. In reviewing the play, Art McFarlane from The Village Voice opined that Amiri's last play revisits a schizophrenic 1950s moment when the internationalism of African-American intellectuals clashed with McCarthyism's isolationist paranoia. And many of us probably do not remember that time, but we know of the time during McCarthy's era, when writers and artists and filmmakers were censored and sometimes put in jail. James Baldwin told us that the story of the Black man in America is the story of America. So let us historicize and teach American history and literature from multiple perspectives. Let us ensure that we are engaged in culturally responsive pedagogies in our educational institutions. Let us truly understand what critical race theory means, which is really looking at how race impacts the criminal justice system, housing, and healthcare. Let us press hard to make sure that our students are aware of these threats to democracy. How many students tell you they don't listen to the news? They don't know what's going on. We, again, that's our responsibility to make them aware. And John Edgar Wideman, wonderful storyteller, says that what we cannot speak, we must convey in stories. So sometimes you can't convey it in the reality, in the way you see it, but stories give us a way to convey what we cannot speak. So let us provide our students with ways to tell their stories. In The Fire Next Time, James Baldwin warns us that if white America does not change its attitudes and policies towards Black Americans and alter the conditions under which Blacks were forced to live, violence would result. So let us avoid violence and the fire that has resulted. Commit to making good trouble in our classrooms and in our public spaces. Thank you.